humanoids or intelligence or cells or life of any sort anywhere else in the universe. I started to think maybe all those astronomers were wrong-headed in their quest, that the difference between life and non-life was minimal, at best, probably beside the point. We'd gotten it backward. We'd pointed our telescopes into space in hopes of seeing ourselves and seen so many clumps of chemicals reflected back. There was no helping the boredom, I thought. After Abe died, after Leo and Patra left, there was no changing the loneliness. Chapter 22. The first day of 10th grade, I got up earlier than I needed to. As my parents slept in the room behind the kitchen, I got dressed, jeans, green wool sweater, boots, and pumped the little propane stove next to the sink. At first, the blue light of the gas was all I could see by, but as the water began to thrum in the pot, a bit of gray September day showed itself through the one window. Pine shivered in the wind off the water. I filtered coffee through a wet cloth, poured the oily black brew into my dad's thermos, nestled the thermos in my backpack. The dogs whined even after I let them out of the shed, pulling on their stakes, dropping dew from their chains. They'd become accustomed to me again over the summer. They'd come to expect more than a pat or two, though I didn't have time for that now. I poured their kibble sloppily, shoved their four bowls against the woodpile. They were always hungrier than they were affectionate, anyhow. They didn't look up again once they got their breakfast. The highway was empty, still. Early fall fog clung to the trees on the edges, muffling sounds making the five-mile walk into town a long slide from one four-foot patch of asphalt to the next. I swung my arms against the chill. I got my heart going, and once I did, I couldn't slow it down again. When I got to Maine, I took a sharp right behind Katerina's gas station. It didn't look like she'd opened the place up yet. The plexiglass window on the side of the shop was still dark. Out back, she had the hides of two bucks strung up on poles, which would have interested me usually, but I was in a hurry and didn't stop. I followed the wet woods path past the old timber mill, whose charred black boards rose higher than the pines and got lost in the fog overhead. I kept going. I went around to the bank of Gone Lake, where I knew Katerina kept a second aluminum canoe, unused for years. After a few minutes of searching, I found the battered canoe sunk in cattails and mud a little way down from the creek mouth. Wading into the mud, I turned the thing over, first draining the water, and clean the mucky seats with the sleeve of my sweater. The sun was burning the fog off the lake now, the surface dimpled with minnows below and water striders above. I dipped the paddles in the cold creek water to rinse them clean, then propped them up against the beach canoe. All ready to go. All ready for Lily. Back in town, back at the baseball field behind the school, I sat down on the batter's bench and waited. I knew Lily's dad usually dropped her off not far from here on his way to the Forest Service station. If she was coming to school, if she was coming at all, I meant to head her off on the way to the door. I had something to give her, and I wanted to give it to her in the canoe. My idea was to tell her I'd gotten a letter in the mail for Mr. Grierson. And if she didn't believe that, I'd explain how close we were, Mr. Grierson and I. Closer than it seemed, because of History Odyssey. I'd written the letter myself the night before. I'd snuck a beer from the shed and a good ink pen from my mom's craft supplies beneath the sink. Sitting cross-legged in my loft after my parents went to sleep, I'd written on a yellow legal pad in careful block letters. I'd only had to think of Patra kneeling in front of Leo in the hotel to get the picture I needed in my head. After that, the words came easy. I had this letter for Lily, sealed. I wanted to take her somewhere she couldn't get away while I watched her read it. The canoe in Gone Lake would be perfect, but if that made Lily suspicious, then it could be the woods behind the gas station where Katerina kept her buckskins and bloody axes and pails. Or I could do it here at school. If she wouldn't go with me to the lake, here in the stiff grass with the hockey players watching. They could watch if they wanted. In the end, I didn't care. Somewhere between home and the baseball field, I'd gotten angry. Somewhere between August and September, I'd grown a pins and needles feeling on my neck and scalp, a tightness in my chest that almost never went away. Couldn't bear to walk down Main Street anymore, even to get tackle at Bob's shop, because that's where the bank was with my babysitting money inside. I couldn't go by the elementary school or even to the Forest Service Nature Center, which used to be my favorite place in the world. I couldn't go anywhere or be anyone. I was trembling as I waited in the baseball field. I was hoping Lily would arrive before the final bell rang. I saw her dad's pickup a few minutes after the last buses took off. He did a little half-turn against the curb, so a mess of 2x4s and an open cooler slid around in the bed. I stood up and shakily drew the letter from my pocket. Seeing that pickup arrive when I wasn't sure she'd come at all, seeing Lily open the passenger door, made everything else I would do to her seem inevitable. Now things would simply run their course. Now, one way or another, she would see this was not playing, what she'd said. That you couldn't just do whatever you wanted to someone and get away with it. When she climbed out of the cab, I saw her hair was wet. It swung in clumped ropes on either side of her head, and she was strangely unsteady. She had to hold the pickup door with two hands as she got out, and for a second I thought, oh no, she's drunk. But then I saw she had a belly so big that her red hoodie didn't quite cover it. So big I could almost see the baby inside her when the sun hit her skin. The outline, a terrible, tiny person there, I swear. But no, it was just her veins, a branchwork of purple lines that were covered again when she pulled down her shirt. I didn't step forward and say her name. I didn't approach because of that belly of hers and because I saw as she waddled toward me. She was wearing the black suede boots I'd left at her house 3 months ago. She was wearing my boots, which shone a dark plum color in the morning sun. I just nodded at her as she passed, as she glanced once in my direction and then onto the next thing, the door, the crowd of hockey players in their white caps on the curb who'd caught sight of her now and were staring outright. School. 10th grade. Dear Lily, I've been wanting to write you a note for a very long time. I'm having Maddie give you this letter because everybody will be watching you for correspondence from me, and nobody will be watching her. What I need to tell you is I can't stop thinking about what you said last spring. I think about your fantasy of Gone Lake all the time, every day, every minute. I think about it so much that it's all very clear to me now. Like something that actually happened. Like something we really did. Did you intend that? I think maybe you did. I think about the feeling of your lips on my skin in that boat. I think about the feeling of my dick in the back of your throat, you sucking me down. And then, your sweet look of surprise when I finish. Can you imagine how deep it went, how good it was, how long I lasted? How I drew it out for you at just the right moment. Did you feel all that, Lily, you fucking pervert? Even now, in the murky moments before sleep, I sometimes think about what it would have been like to have taken Lily out on Gone Lake that day in the canoe. I think about it when nothing else works. When I can't find a way to jostle myself from the overwhelming sense of quiet in my new little room in the rehabbed cabin. In my mind, I go through the ritual preparations methodically, staving off all feeling of any sort, heating a kettle on the stove, filling a thermos with coffee in the early morning, and slipping it in my backpack, ambushing Lily when her dad drops her off in the schoolyard, saying to her, "Let's cut class this once." Saying, "Let's have a smoke, catch a few crappie, okay?" She's reluctant in my dream of her, but then magically we're out on the boat, out in the bright center of Gone Lake. The waves are shushing the boat around, and it's early fall, a couple of hours past dawn, and Lily's wet hair hangs in cords down her back. Her teeth are chattering, and her lips are white, and she's only wearing one of her sheer sweaters, no jacket or gloves. I see the cold curl her thin shoulders in, but I cannot feel it myself. No cold, no wind. I feel nothing. When she turns around to flick out her cigarette, the one I lit for her, I lunge and take her paddle from her. She gives me a confused look, so I tell her quietly, "You knew what was going to come next." Then I creep from the back of the canoe toward her. I feel the boat like my whole body going under me, the thing rocking back and forth, shuddering and tipping us both off balance. I say to her when I get close, warningly, menacingly, perhaps, but also with tender commiseration, "Just a kiss." It feels almost like a benediction giving her this. The violence in me is almost overwhelming. "That's what you wanted, right? Just a kiss." And then there's this. Even now when those words move through my mind, like a curse or a wish, I become Lily. It happens just like that. I have to go through all the preparations for it to work. I have to heat the coffee, fill the thermos, wipe down the wet canoe seats with my sleeve. I have to paddle through the rolling water for a long time and do it silently and let Lily ride silently in the front. I have to be patient. I have to do all the steps. But by the time the shore is a huge ring of horizon around us, by the time I've taken her paddle and seen the look of recognition on her face, I find I'm the one stranded in the boat. I'm the one shivering with cold. I feel everything. And I'm the one wanted more than anyone else. The End. This book was read for you by Susan Bennett, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you've enjoyed this production of History of Wolves by Emily Friedland. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.